all Bezawar could do to keep from being trampled by the people running for their lives behind him.
Bezawar!
Prad grabbed him under the armpit on the bad knee side and half carried him forward, or he would have certainly been swept under and crushed. On the other side of the Predark turnoff to the Welcome Center, Bezawar could see weak light reflecting off small pools and trenches filled with standing water. The ruined stretch of road was littered with mounds of earth and thick, up-tilted slabs of concrete reinforced with rebar. Such was the only cover. Bezawar and Prad three-legged raced to the disrupted zone. Ahead of them, Ferdinando leapt over the first of the water hazards and dived behind a three-foot-high pile of rubble. Prad gave Bezawar a hard shove, sending him and his crutch skidding into an open trench. The water was cold and hip-deep, but it was shielded from incoming fire by a canted slab of concrete. Prad followed him. Although it was getting lighter by the second, Haldane's gunners couldn't see exactly what they were shooting at. The slow and the unfortunate were chopped down, disintegrated by converging, triangulated gunfire. A wash of hot blood and guts sprayed over Bezawar's head. He crouched lower, chin under the water, unable to breathe for his own fear. In dawn's glimmer, Bezawar saw still bodies. He saw quivering bodies. Others crawled, mortally wounded. The water in the swineherd's trench had turned red. Of the 100 or so who marched into the Valley of Death, 80 survivors had found cover. Bezawar was astonished to see that Milash the Impaler was still astride his horse, and now he rode back and forth while bullets sailed all around him, taunting the gun positions. The other fodder was stunned by his bravery too. The Baron and his horse seemed impervious to volleys of lead. He spurred his steed behind a wide, up-tilted section of roadway and dismounted.
Ready for some payback? Open fire!
Shoot! Shoot! Get the bastard!
The more cautious shooters fired blind and one-handed, upward in the general direction of the bill. Others stuck their heads out from behind cover and actually aimed. They were the unlucky ones. Now the Sunspot gunners had muzzle flashes to aim at. Some of the junk AKs began blowing up on their own. What metal and wood the shooters didn't absorb with their bodies and heads flew through the air. Those with assault rifles that didn't explode or jam kept on shooting. Ferdinando moved up and down the ragged firing line and passed out extra 30-round mags. The enemy, for its part, was unleashing tens of thousands of rounds, and every bullet fired in this direction was a bullet that couldn't be used to turn back the main attack.
Conserve your ammo! Space your shots! Let them burn out their gun barrels!
Milash turned to his horse and opened one of the saddlebags. He took out a fat-barreled, orange-colored handgun. He broke open the barrel to make sure it was loaded, then snapped it shut. Cocking the strange weapon, the Baron aimed it over the top of the concrete slab that protected him and his horse. The round trailed a thin coil of smoke as it sailed away. Bezawar could easily follow its path. It flew in a high, looping arc toward Sunspot, reaching its apex high above the berm walls. The bright red flash against the lavender sky signaled the beginning of the end. Earlier, Doc Tanner had sat huddled with his back pressed against a wall of hurricane fence, his long legs tucked up under his chin. His hands and feet were unbound, but his lama and sword stick had been confiscated by Haldane's men. The holding cell in which he had been placed was actually a cage, with wire on five sides and a 6x12 concrete pad for a floor. Completely open to the elements, it stood next to the Welcome Center building. It was Death Row. 20 feet away, two armed guards had stood beside a barrel fire. Behind them were the Ville's extensive communal gardens. Doc tried to move as little as possible. Moving hurt. He was sore from his lengthy interrogation by Haldane's secmen, which consisted of short periods of questioning, interrupted by long periods of kicking and punching. They had asked him how close Milash's army was. They had asked him if attack was imminent. Doc had chosen to profess ignorance. To offer any information to his interrogators meant committing to something that he would have had to keep track of. After a few hours, the soldiers realized they couldn't break him. Killing him would have robbed the garrison of the drama of the hanging ceremony, certainly the high point of the week. On top of that, They'd gotten tired of knocking him around. The knowledge that Milosh and his army were coming, and soon, helped Doc endure the punishment. He knew that Haldane's men were outnumbered 3-1. If he wasn't going to survive the battle for Sunspot, he was confident that most of his torturers weren't either. He would dance at the end of a rope, satisfied that he had saved his dear companions' lives, and that they in turn would avenge his murder. The guards at the burn barrel jumped. The Welcome Center garrison doors opened, and armed troops raced to their battle stations. One of the barrel guards took off as well, disappearing around a corner on a dead run. The remaining guard, who had enthusiastically participated in the interrogation, looked over at the caged Doc Tanner. Doc rose to his feet as the short, skinny man stepped up to the wire, a nasty look on his weather-seamed face. He dropped his AK's fire selector lever to full auto and stuck the muzzle through the fence.
You think your pal Milosh is gonna save you? Think again.
Doc saw steel points suddenly protrude through the front of the guard's t-shirt, pitching four little pup tents in the fabric. Black blood drooled from his parted lips, spilling down his chest. Then Doc saw Isabel standing behind the guard, her hands gripping the handle of a pitchfork. With a vicious twist, Isabel freed the fork. The guard staggered backward, clutching his chest with both hands. She pivoted from her hips and sent the end of the fork handle into the side of his head. He dropped to his knees. Isabel put down her weapon and searched the dead man's pockets. She quickly found the keys to the cage's lock.
Madam, I am forever in your debt.
No time for thanks, let's go.
Isabel pulled the AK from the wire, where it hung by its muzzle in front sight.
I must collect my own armament before we proceed. I know where it is.
Theo, we don't have time!
Ignoring her protests, Doc trotted around the side of the building and pushed through the Welcome Center's front doors.
Theo, no!
Leaning against the cinder block wall was a pair of huge, 2-inch-thick steel plates designed to reinforce the flimsy entry doors. Torches and stanchions lit a hallway that led to the reception area. It was obvious that men had been sleeping on the tiled floor. There were mattresses of piled cardboard, ratty blankets, and dirty clothes scattered around. There was also evidence that at some earlier time, intense fighting had taken place inside the building. Everywhere he looked, there were bullet craters. Doc made a beeline for the information desk, which was pocked and splintered with slug holes. He rounded the counter and bent behind it. Fumbling on the top shelf, he found his ebony-handled walking stick.
Ah, good. Still in pristine condition.
The door behind the counter opened, and a soldier stepped out. He was as surprised to see Doc as Doc was to see him. Doc lunged from his knees, driving with both legs. The rapier's point entered just below the soldier's sternum and slipped into his torso like a well-oiled scabbard, all the way to the hilt. As Doc whipped the blade back out, he rolled his wrist and forearm, cutting a precise overhand figure eight, which severed the heart from its major blood vessels. Doc wiped the blade on the man's shirt tail, then retrieved his Lama and its Mexican rig holster, which he found in a cardboard box on the bottom shelf. Then he retraced his steps back outside, where Isabel waited. Doc followed Isabel past the portable gibbet, where he had been scheduled to hang. The Ville's head woman cut across the compound, moving low and fast. She took him between the rows of wheelless Winnebagos, converted semi-trailers, and cargo containers, where the people of Sunspot made their homes. No one stepped out of the shadows to challenge them. All of Haldane's soldiers had moved to defensive positions on the burn. Accustomed to invasion, the Ville folk had taken cover. Isabel led him to one of the cargo containers and pushed aside the sheet of opaque plastic that was its door. The windowless space was lit by a single torch. Tiers of wooden bunks lined one wall, all empty. An oil drum stove stood in the far corner. Two men were waiting inside. At Isabel's signal, the two men shifted the cold stove off its wooden platform, then swung the platform aside, revealing a hole braced with timbers, leading down into blackness. At that moment, Doc realized that the folks of Sunspot weren't the meek victims that they seemed. Isabel shoulder-slung her AK and grabbed the torch from its stanchion.
Stay close or you'll get lost.
Doc followed her into the hole. 4 feet down was a dirt floor. Ahead, under timbered bracing, was a narrow, dusty tunnel. The ceiling was so low that Doc had to drop to his hands and knees and crawl. After 30 feet or so, the tunnel grew taller, and the earthen walls, floor, and ceiling gave way to bedrock. Doc got to his feet. though he still had to lower his head to keep it from hitting the roof. The passage was triangular-shaped, narrower at the bottom than the top, a natural fissure in the stone. Because of the tunnel's gradual turns, it was difficult for Doc to keep track of their direction. They encountered numerous pitch-dark side passages in the bare rock. He had no way of telling whether they were dead ends.
Do these passages provide the Skagworms access to the Ville proper?
They do, unfortunately. We've blocked off the tunnels we know they are using, but they keep finding new ways in.
This is how they decimated your stock of pigs.
Hogs are no match for the big old Skagworm sows. They burrow up under the sty, get hold of the hog's legs, and pull them down into the tunnels. Even though we knew it was coming when it happened so fast we couldn't stop it. The poor bastard, guarding the last pig, jumped into the hole after it. He let out a scream and was never seen again. They like their food alive and kicking, and warm-blooded.
After they had traveled for a few minutes more, Isabel hopped down into a wide, low-ceilinged stone chamber, brightly lit by a ring of torches. Doc paused on the verge. Leaning against the far wall, he saw a row of AKs and olive-drab ammo cans. Armed men and women, at least 25 of them, stood waiting, grim-faced. Doc dropped down into the room. The muzzles of all the assault rifles swung up to cover him.
Put up your hands.
As you wish.
Are you a spy for Baron Melosh?
A most unwilling spy. Melosh holds my dearest friends as hostages. Their lives hang in the balance. I had no choice.
You bastard. You lied to me.
Would you lie to save your people?
I have lied. I have chilled to save them.
And you are ready to die in that cause?
Of course.
Then what separates us is a distinction without a difference, my dear.
The difference is you put my people at risk.
The risk existed, whether I cooperated with Melosh or not. He is intent on retaking this Ville.
Why did you walk away from me last night?
I would no more dishonor you, Isabel, than I would myself.
Isabel gave him a searching look. She was handsome, brave, intelligent, and utterly capable. There was the promise of great tenderness in her lovely eyes.
It was not for lack of desire, I assure you. I could not betray you in that way. Thankfully, such an abomination was not part of the terms the Impaler dictated to me. Madam, I did only what I had to do in order to save my friends. Nothing more. I owe them my life many times over. If it costs me my life now, so be it. Do what you will.
After a pause, Isabel waved for her people to lower their weapons.
If you thought I was really Melosh's spy, why did you not just let them execute me?
My husband Paul was hanged by Haldane's head Sekhman Bollinger. Have you ever seen a person chilled that way?
Regrettably, yes.
He was Sunspot's duly elected leader. Paul never personally raised a hand against either the Barons or their Sekhmen. He was trying to hold things together, trying to keep as many Ville folk alive as he could. Some people here called him an appeaser, but it wasn't true. He wanted freedom for the Ville, an end to occupation. It was Paul who discovered the honeycomb of tunnels under the Ville. Though Paul tried, he couldn't control a small group of Ville hotheads. They insisted on not just sabotaging, but chilling our oppressors. It started with poisonings in the garrison mess, which were blamed on bad water, bad food, or contagious disease. Bloody revenge murders weren't so easily dismissed. Bollinger caught the guilty ones, and hanged Paul, too, because he hadn't turned them in.
Why didn't you side with Melosh, then?
One Baron is just as bad as the other. Both of them bleed us dry. Which one was in charge at the time didn't matter. It could have easily been Melosh who hanged Paul.
How have you kept this tunnel system a secret?
The entrances are concealed inside the cargo containers. For reasons of personal safety, the Baron's troopers don't like to enter them. When they do search our homes, it's over quickly. There's another entrance near the latrines in the garden.
You intend to throw off your shackles by force of arms?
We have been planning it ever since Paul's murder, and we've armed ourselves with good weapons and ammo stolen from our enemies.
Do you really think you can defeat both Melosh and Haldane?
We have no choice. Will you fight with us?
Either my companions are safe or they are not. Either way, there is nothing more I can do for them at present. Under the circumstances, I would be most honored to join your cause. My gun and my sword are at your service, madam.
Malasha's real attack has started.
The walls and floor shuddered violently, and a section of the stone ceiling broke free and came down on top of them. As Doc grabbed Isabel's arm and swung her out of the path of the massive deadfall, clouds of dust rose over them and the other survivors, extinguishing most of the torches.
Gather the weapons and ammo! We've got to get out of here!
Ryan stretched the cramps out of his legs. He figured the Haldane Sekhmen who weren't assigned to defend the north wall would be scrambling up the slope of Loose Scree on the south side, eager for the chance to rip off a few clips at a pinned-down enemy. The machine gun in front of them was his one and only concern. Ryan waited for JB and Mildred to come closer to him.
The big gun position is going to be tough to crack. Its kill zone runs through nearly 180 degrees of arc, and there's just bare ground between it and us.
The officers brought along plenty of grins. Braggers.
The emplacement's SUV is buttoned up tight with plate steel. The windshield and side windows are covered. The wag is sitting on its rims, and the undercarriage is maybe 6 inches off the ground. The only decent-sized opening is in the roof behind the machine gun, report for the gunner. It's gonna take a hell of a pitch to drop a friend down that hole.
Nuke in hell!
A flare burst high over the bill. It cast a sickly red light as it drifted down out of sight behind the wall of dirt and rubble. If they could see Malasha's attack signal, the trooper behind the Haldane machine gun could too.
Get ready!
Ryan tightened his grip on the Sig Sauer and braced himself to charge over the top of the cliff. Farther down the cliff edge, he saw Malasha's officers yank the pins on the grins they each held. They let the safety levers flip off, then lobbed the bombs in high arcs toward the emplacement. As the companions crouched, the stench of burned Comp B swept over them. Mildred and JB started to move forward. Ryan put out both arms, holding them back. Other Norm fighters concealed below the summit weren't as cautious. Following their officer's command, the first 20 vaulted the cliff edge and charged. The first wave of the attack was over. None of the attackers had survived it. The officers reared back and chucked a second round of grins. This time, the gunner wasn't caught off guard. When he saw the grins arcing toward him, he abandoned the gun and ducked into the protection of the armored wag. The grins hit the hood of the Suburban and bounced or rolled off. Again, they hadn't managed to hit the hole. The second wave of attackers surged over the hilltop. They burst onto the killing ground, now a blood-slick obstacle course of sprawled bodies.
This is getting us nowhere. Give me a grin!
An officer dug out a fragger from his bag and underhanded it to Ryan. He caught the bomb in his left hand.
JB, Mildred, cover me!
Ryan waited for the officers to pitch the third helping of pre-dark grins. With the shrap still flying, Ryan was up and over the cliff edge. He ran low and quick through the rolling white smoke, his boot heels landing on the bodies and body parts. As he raced for the bumper of the SUV, the grin smoke began to thin out. A dark head and shoulders popped up behind the roof-mounted M60. Ryan saw the gunner shoulder the stock and grip the foregrip. Then the gunner tipped the barrel down to put Ryan in its sights. Ryan threw himself against the Suburban's grill. The leading edge of the hood turned a ragged rent above Ryan's head. Just then, JB and Mildred opened fire on the shooter from the edge of the cliff. The gunner reacted by swinging up his sights at them. Ryan pulled the grin safety clip and yanked the pin. Holding down the safety lever, he crawled from the front to the left side of the wag. When he was below the front passenger door, as close to the gunner as he could get, he let the lever flip off. He sprang to his feet and stuffed the grin in the gap between the edge of the hole and the very startled man's back. The gunner tried to turn the muzzle on him, but Ryan blocked the barrel and gas cylinder swing with his forearm. Ryan looked into the man's eyes, then dropped to his knees, letting the barrel pivot over his head. The explosion blew the gunner clean out of the makeshift turret. He landed face down and smoking on the Suburban's hood. Half of him, anyway. The rest was a goulash of bloody shreds and stripped bones. Shielded somewhat by the gun turret, Ryan was just knocked flat on his butt. He rose and waved JB and Mildred forward. The gun emplacement at the west gate tried to nail them as they crossed the bloody ground in a sprint. They dived for cover behind the smoking hulk of the Suburban. Protected by the side of the emplacement, JB and Mildred knelt next to Ryan. The one-eyed man looked back toward the cliff edge and saw one of their officers running toward the berm with a hefty satchel charge.
The gun position has got an open exit door on the veal side of the berm. Let's use it.
JB climbed into the hulk first, followed by Mildred. Ryan lowered himself in through the hole in the roof. At once he was slammed by the coppery sweet reek and the intense residual heat. Blood and pulverized bone and pureed intestinal contents dripped from every interior surface. Stuck through the Suburban's open rear doors was a 3-foot-wide, corrugated steel culvert pipe that ran through the berm wall. JB disappeared down it. Mildred was right on his heels. Ryan dropped to his knees and crawled into the opening. Something heavy landed on the backs of Ryan's calves. He looked over his shoulder to see the canvas satchel of high explosives, 30 pounds worth. He didn't try to throw it back out again. If the strap got hung up on the machine gun, or if the officer was still outside, throwing it wouldn't do any good. Throwing it would just eat up precious seconds.
Shit!
Ryan slid out of the open end of the pipe and hit the ground running. JB and Mildred were moving toward the nearest cover, ignorant of what was coming. There was no time to fill in the pertinent details.
Hurry!
They ducked behind a rusting cab over camper, propped up on concrete blocks.
Shit!
The camper was knocked off its blocks and tipped over, almost landing on top of them. The satchel charge had blown the Suburban apart and taken out a pie-shaped wedge of berm along with it. As the smoke lifted, Alasha's fighters poured through the gap, only to be met by the automatic weapons of Haldane defenders. Ryan, JB, and Mildred whirled to face the fresh attack. Some 75 yards away, Haldane soldiers crouched next to the culvert opening of the gateside gunpost, firing assault rifles. Ryan swung the SIG up in a two-handed grip. Christy and Jack were waiting on the path halfway up the cliffside when the satchel charge detonated. Boulders and chunks of concrete blown sky-high bounced down the cliff face, as did the gunpost's front axle and V8 engine block. The norms closer to the summit were swept off the path by falling heavy debris. Cartwheeling bodies flew past. Along the base of the cliff, a rubbish heap of rock, metal, and torn flesh accumulated. Christy thanked Gaia that she hadn't seen Ryan in free fall.
They've broken through the berm! Let's go! Everyone up!
Christy and Jack advanced behind the last of the Norm fighters. Behind them came the Swampies and their dogs. The Hellhounds could smell the blood and the fear in the air. Christy could smell it too. The drooling animals scrambled up the path, half dragging their stumpy handlers. As Christy climbed toward Sunspotville, the small arms fire above intensified. Haldane defenders were trying to turn back the spear point of the assault. With Jack at her side, she jumped onto the summit, her Smith & Wesson 640 in her hand. The first thing she saw was the smoking ruin where the SUV gunpost had been. The satchel charge had blown a 12-foot gap in the berm. Nothing of the WAG remained. Ryan, Mildred, and JB were nowhere in sight. Jack led Christy into the breach. The Norm fighters were jammed up on the far side, pinned by gunfire from the maze of WAGs and semi-trailers, and from the sides of the Welcome Center and the garden behind.
Follow me!
There was no time to locate their companions. To stand still was suicide. Christy and Jack melded into the Mutie force, sprinting across Sunspot's hammered ground with the Swampies and their dogs. The Norm fighters put up a wall of covering fire, allowing most of their genetically challenged comrades to safely slip into the northernmost edge of the wagon trailer shantytown. Korb led the 45 Mutie unit into a narrow, rutted path between rusting vehicular hovels, the tallest of which was about 15 feet high. The back streets of Sunspot weren't laid out in anything that remotely resembled a grid work. The tracks between structures wound back and forth, and the bends concealed what lay just beyond them. Empty clotheslines sagged across the lanes. No villfolk were in evidence. They either were hiding under their mattresses, or they'd taken cover elsewhere. The Norm contingent was drawing the defenders' full attention. They had traveled about 50 feet into the maze. The Mutie fighters ducked into the crudely hacked doorways and between the junkyard wags.
Let the dogs have them!
The dogs disappeared around the bend.
Forward!
The Muties advanced to the bend, clubs, machetes, and axes ready for the mopping up. When Christy and Jack reached that vantage point, she raised her .38, and he aimed his Colt Python, but neither of them fired. Four of the swampy helmets had a Haldane trooper trapped in front of a shambles of a Winnebago Brave. When he looked away, one of the beasts coiled and sprang at him, stretched out full length. The trooper pivoted and fired his AK from the hip. The hound twisted in midair and crashed lifeless to the ground behind him. The other dogs were on him in a heartbeat. Suddenly, one of the club-wielding swampies jerked forward, blood from a horrendous throat wound pouring down his chest as it gushed from his mouth.
Take cover!
Two of the dogs jumped on the wounded swampy's back, took him down, and dragged his now limp body into the shadows under a semi-trailer. It didn't take a doomie to know what was going to happen next. Loosed from their chains, the dogs were independent purveyors of mayhem.
Forget them! We've got to cut off Haldane's men. Take out as many as we can before they hole up in the Welcome Center.
Korb waved his muties forward, his 12-gauge pump braced against his hip, its muzzle sweeping the line of pre-dark wrecks. When he neared the spot where the swampy had been shot, he flattened himself against the side of a cargo container. But the shooter had moved to get a better angle. He shot Korb square in the eggplant-colored balloon-like mass that covered the right side of his face. With their leader's death, with gunfire and Gren blasts on all sides, all illusion of unit cohesion evaporated. It was every muty bastard for him or herself. Like the hellhounds, the swampies and the various malformed immediately beat feet, disappearing through gaps in the rows of wags and trailers. Christie had had no bone to pick with Baron Haldane or his troops, no blood grudge to settle, neither had Jack. All they wanted was to locate their companions and depart, leaving the fighting to those who cared or had no choice.
Gaia!
Christie felt the breeze from that shot. All bets were off now. Jack grabbed her arm, and they dashed across the narrow path to the side of a derelict truck. By crossing the road in the sniper's direction, they had cut off his narrow shooting angle, which ran between the parked wags and trailers. Jack and Christie rounded the rear of the vehicle, moving into the next lane. As they stepped out from cover, a figure to their right ducked around the bend in the otherwise deserted path. The sniper had been trying to reposition to get off another clean shot. Realizing the pursuit was after him, he was beating a hasty retreat, presumably toward the Welcome Center.
Jack, the Welcome Center's the key!
None of the combatants on either side wore uniforms or insignia. Indeed, Melosh was the only fighter recognizable at a distance. Once the berm wall had been breached, after preliminary defenses were overrun, attackers scattered by counterattack, it was almost impossible to tell friend from foe. In the narrow, shadowy lanes and across the stretches of open ground, whoever shot at you was the enemy. Haldane's men did have a strategic advantage, though. They could keep from accidentally killing one another by withdrawing to the Welcome Center. It was a fort within a fort. They could hold out behind its concrete block walls for a long time, perhaps until reinforcements arrived from Nuevaville. Jack dashed after the escaping sniper. Christie had longer legs than he did, but she couldn't match his speed. By the time she reached the bend in the lane, he already had his Colt Python up and aimed. 40 feet away, the .357 Magnum slug found its running target. Christie and Jack hurried past him without a backward look. Christie and Jack leapfrogged each other from bend to bend, running between the scabrous huts and wrecked wags. They glanced into the crudely sawn doorways and windows, but there was no sign of the Ville folk. When the end of the lane came into view ahead, they could see fighters moving across the mouth from left to right in the direction of the Welcome Center. They couldn't tell whether the fighters belonged to Melosh or Haldane.
Sounds like those hellhounds have formed a hunting pack.
Bad news for anybody near them.
Christie and Jack reached the end of the path, which was framed by a refrigerator semi-trailer and a trailways bus, and stole a cautious look around the corner. They had a clear view of the Bill's gardens and the Welcome Center beyond. The rows of crops, staked tomato plants, waist-high corn, pole beans, and peppers, ran east and west, perpendicular to their point of view. Haldane's men were holding off attackers from behind the building's pillars and concrete planters, allowing their comrades to withdraw to the center's front doors, a fighting retreat. There were only a few Haldane troopers left on the berm's southern ridge.
We haven't seen Ville folk anywhere. Maybe they've all been herded into the Welcome Center so they can be used as hostages.
Look!
Jack pointed to the left with his python. Christie had already seen it. Behind a row of 4-foot-tall tomato plants, a head bobbed along at high speed. It was wearing a red stocking cap.
I'll get you bastards!
Meconium. His hand swung up, and silver flashed. The hatchet. Ahead of him, something else was moving at high speed, something even shorter than meconium. Two tow-headed boys dashed out of the tomatoes into the stands of corn. They ran as if their lives depended on it. With the hatchet-waving Swampy gaining on them, the children abruptly turned left, bursting through the corn stalks side by side, heading straight for Christy and Jack. The smaller of the two tripped and landed hard on his stomach. Before he could get up, Meconium was astride him with his stout legs, raising the hatchet high overhead.
Into the line, shortstop!
Jack raised his python as Meconium reared back to strike the boy.
My ear!
But the Swampy's movement had shifted his head just far enough to save his life. The other blonde boy skidded to a stop, taking cover behind Christy's long legs. She took two-handed aim at Meconium's forehead with her revolver.
You want to lower that chopper.
Meconium obeyed, dropping his hatchet arm. Thick blood leaking from his ear hole. While Christy held the rad bastard covered, Jack grabbed the kid by the shirt collar and dragged him out from between the Swampy's legs.
Come on, you mutts! Dinner time! Oh, you're in for it now, Mr. Not-a-Mutie.
Over his shoulder, the tops of the plants whipped back and forth, stirred not by wind, but by dogs as they bounded across the rows. Not all of the hounds had responded to Meconium's summons, just the ones still hungry for blood.
Shit!
Run!
Christy and Jack grabbed the boys and raced back into the lane. They dragged the boys up the steps of an ancient Trailways bus. Sweeping aside a sheet of tattered opaque plastic, they ducked into the doorway. It was dim and dank inside, and it reeked of sour wood smoke and mildew. The driver's seat had been torn out, but the steering wheel and pedals were still there. No passenger window survived. The openings were blocked by plywood or sheet metal scrap. What light there was came through the doorway's plastic and through rows of small glass rectangles that decorated the seam between walls and roof. Christy shoved the boys in front of her. All the passenger seats had been pulled out, except for a narrow path down the middle. The floor was covered with straw-stuffed pallets and plastic bags full of wadded-up clothes. A table had been built in along one wall. Made from a scavenged interior door, it held a junk store collection of mismatched plates, cups, and steel silverware. Beyond the end of the table was a wood stove, fashioned from an oil drum. Its stovepipe angled outside the bus through a hole hacked in a piece of plywood. The back of the bus was the most defensible position. Christy pushed the boys in the direction of the narrow stainless steel cubicle that had once housed the Trailways' walk-in toilet. The toilet door stood ajar. Jack aimed his python at the top step. When the first dog leapt into the bus, Jack's magnum blew its big bony head to bits, sending hot wet flesh around the steel room. Jack rode the muzzle climb, bringing the blaster back on target for a second shot. He held his fire. Instead of scrambling over their dead packmate, the dogs in the stairwell busied themselves by licking up the cranial splatter that had showered them.
Once they get a taste of blood, they won't never quit, you mean.
What's that bastard doing out there?
Suddenly, the dog jumped out of the open toilet cubicle. Head lowered, fangs bared, ears back, it slinked toward Christy.
Jack, they're coming in back here!
Without taking her eyes off the stalking beast, Christy guided the boys around her and pushed them toward the unlit oil barrel stove. They scurried into the skinny hiding space behind it. Christy hit the hound between the eyes. The animal's bony skull held together, but it was instant death. She stepped over the corpse and looked into the toilet cubicle over the sights of her Model 640. There was a big hole in the floor where the toilet fixture had once stood, which created a connecting passage to the luggage compartment underneath. The compartment that Meconium had opened. Christy slammed the door, and as there was no lock on the outside, she threw her back against it and pushed with her legs to hold it shut. At the front of the bus, Jack's shot debrained another hellhound. Another dog leapt at Jack. 150 pounds of flying dead dog hit Jack head on. The momentum knocked him to the floor. The dog threw itself at the bathroom door, using its body like a battering ram. It took everything Christy had to keep the door shut and the beast out of the compartment. Jack had regained his feet, but in the process, two more dogs had made it up the steps and into the wag. But Christy had bullets left. With a door ramming into her back, she couldn't trust her aim.
Damn!
Christy watched helplessly as one hound grabbed Jack by the pant cuff and tried to pull him off his feet. The other dog was on its hind legs, its huge paws on Jack's shoulders, trying to get a solid bite on his neck. yellow fangs tangled in the long white hair. Ryan returned, aimed rapid fire with his Sig Sauer. The near-miss bullet strikes forced the defenders to cease fire and duck behind the steel culvert, which gave them some cover. Because the culvert stood a couple of feet above the ground, the Haldane Sec Force was only partially protected by it. When JB cut loose with his Uzi, he aimed low on purpose. He chopped the legs out from under three of the enemy fighters. Ryan and JB sprayed the fallen with 9mm rounds, making sure they didn't get up. The three remaining Sec men didn't stick around for the funeral. Two of them took off for the cover of the berm gate, firing their AKs blindly and ineffectively over their hips. The third trooper escaped by climbing into the open end of the pipe head first. Mildred's Czech wheel gun hit one of the running men in the chest, knocking him sideways into the berm. High kicking, the other Sec man reached the safety of the Vill's wag gate, which was a semi-trailer parked across the opening. He dived out of sight under the double rear wheels. Ryan broke into a trot, heading for the culvert entrance to the westernmost machine gun post. The Haldane Sec men who had climbed to the top of the berm to potshot at the cannon fodder now directed their gunfire into the Vill, at the Milosh fighters surging through the breached wall. With the defenders' attention fixed on the main attack, the companions closed on the culvert without drawing fire. They approached it with caution, their weapons up. Nobody went near the opening. At the opposite end of the culvert, on the other side of the berm, the heavy machine gun was raining bloody hell on the Milosh force in the gorge. That had to stop. JB reared back a leg and booted the side of the pipe.
Small arms, not M60s.
The gunpost's defenders were ready for them and determined to hold them out. Without Grenz to chuck up the pipe, the companions had to go to plan B. Under the culvert, three bullet-riddled bodies lay in a bloody tangle. Caught up in the mess were three Soviet-made assault rifles. Ryan pulled one of the AKs out from under a dead man's arm. JB used the toe of his boot to turn over a corpse and then picked up the auto rifle that had been under it. Without bothering to wipe the blood off the wooden stock, they dropped the mags and checked the round counters. Ryan threw a leg over the pipe and slid over the top to the far side. The sound he made drew more fire. There were now two AKs defending the entrance, and they were in position to shred anyone who stepped in front of the culvert. Ryan and JB moved beside the mouth of the pipe, just out of the line of fire. Dropping the selector lever to automatic, Ryan flipped the AK around, holding it upside down, magazine and pistol grip butts toward him. He held onto the end of the clip with his left hand. He held the pistol grip with his right hand, with his thumb inside the trigger guard, resting on the trigger. Ryan leaned forward. Still out of the line of fire, he poked the muzzle's flash hider into the mouth of the culvert. He didn't try to control the weapon's aim point. He emptied the mag, then tossed the blaster to the dirt, making room for JB. JB followed his lead, staying far enough back from the lip of the pipe to avoid return fire. He struck the barrel and gas cylinder into the pipe and flattened the AK's trigger with his thumb. They had fired close to 60 rounds into the confined space of the converted SUV gun emplacement. It was a straight shot to the steel plate that covered the post's front windshield. Nothing but sweet silence came from the machine gun end of the pipe. It had ceased firing into the gorge.
What do you think? Did we get him?
Could be playing possum in there.
Let's make sure.
Ryan kicked over a sprawled body and scooped up the remaining AK by the buttstock. After giving the assault rifle a quick once-over, he stepped in front of the opening. Making no attempt to conceal himself, he fired into the culvert from the hip. There was no answering auto-clatter. The machine gun post was dead. The new gunfire came from the berm's wag gate. They could see the muzzle flashes in the shadows under the trailer. The culvert's lone escapee had summoned others to defend the entrance. Farther along the berm on the gorge side, Haldane's men were abandoning the crest and making for the backside of the welcome center. The companion ran straight for the gate. As he sprinted, JB fanned his Uzi, stitching across the back of the trailer, blowing out all four tires on the rear axle. The trailer dropped hard onto its rims, sending up a cloud of dust. Ryan and Mildred cut left, swinging out wide to flank the Sec men hiding underneath. As they changed course, gunfire broadsided them from the corner of the welcome center. The hastily aimed blasts came from troopers, who were beginning to panic at the rapid turn of events. But success was just a matter of time. Caught out in the flat, companion's only chance was to reach the cover of the wag gate. The shooters under the trailer had other ideas about that. At the front of the bus, Jack struggled to keep the vicious dog from his face. Christine lined up the sights of her .38, tightened down on the trigger. The fucking door knocked off her aim.
Fucking dog in the toilet's not running out of steam!
Jack had his handgun out too, but he was too occupied to use it. One of the hellhounds was on his back, his front paws on his shoulders. The other had hold of his pant leg and was dragging him backward, shaking its head, twisting its powerful body as it tried to flip him to the floor of the bus. Jack couldn't spin around and shoot either one of them without ending up on his face. It took everything he had just to keep his balance and keep the dog from clamping onto his neck. Christy waited for the next slam against her back. Despite the fact that she was leaning back with her full weight, the door jumped open an inch or two, driven by 150 pounds of canine battering ram. Christy felt the dog bounce off. She immediately turned and pressed the muzzle against the door, angling it towards the toilet floor. Christy glanced at the children cowering behind the stove as she braced herself to fire. Then she was looking over the Smith's sights at Jack, sliding helplessly backward. The slug smacked into the beast's spine at the base of its thick neck. It slid off Jack into a heap. Partially freed, Jack twisted from his hips and aimed down at the head of the dog that had hold of his pant leg. The point-blank .357 Magnum round left a smoking crater down to the hinge point of its jaws. Its brains and tongue were blown out through the front of its throat. Jack swung his python up to cover the bus entrance. Both he and Christy waited for long seconds, anticipating another attack. But nothing came up the steps, and nothing burst out of the dented toilet door. Either that was all the dog's meconium could gather, or they decided to try some easier prey.
Let's get out of here, kids.
Jack was already heading down the steps. Outside, Jack saw the head swampy running down the lane, away from the Welcome Center. Maybe he was hoping to link up with his fellow swampies. Safety in numbers. Jack had his gun up, tracking the slow-moving target, but he didn't shoot. Swampies couldn't run for shit. Their legs were too short and heavy. Meconium's stumpy arms pumped, his barrel chest heaved, but he was going nowhere fast.
He's mine.
Jack took off after the swampy, running in long, loping strides, his white hair flying. Christy ran after him, with the children in tow. The swampy glanced over his shoulder, hatchet in hand, seemingly weighing the odds if he stopped and fought back. Jack threw himself forward. Jack tackled him, pile-driving his bearded face into the dirt. Before Meconium could recover, the albino ripped the hatchet from his hand. Jack turned the swampy onto his back and straddled him. He didn't reach for his holstered Colt python. When the swampy tried to buck him off, Jack raised the hatchet overhead. The swampy stared up at his own pre-dark camp axe. The head had an edge on one side, and it was flattened on the other for use as a hammer. Jack held the blade side cocked to strike, and with his free hand, he ripped off the red knit cap. Christy turned the boys' faces away from what was about to happen. But she kept looking.
This don't change a fucking thing. You're still a mutie.
I'm not a mutie.